London dropped its dignity.
Yeah.
So has France and Germany.
Yeah.
All hands are dancing to a raggedy melody full of originality.
Sing it, though.
Hello, and welcome to Yesterday's Chip Paper, the fortnightly-ish podcast where we run through strange and bizarre and oddball stories from historic newspaper archives. My name is Violet.
And mine is Jim. And we are, as we've mentioned every episode so far, a couple of transatlantic researchers. And every 2 weeks or so, we will get together and we'll tell each other about a story that we have found in newspaper archives. And this week, it's my turn to talk about a story. And this story isn't fun, really.
Right. Well, you know what? That's a great start to any podcast.
Yes. This is...
Guys, we're not having any fun for at least another 45 minutes.
Buckle...
Maybe longer.
Up, is what I would say to anybody listening to this podcast right now. It's, even the way into the article isn't fun. There was an article...
Oh man, I'm bored already.
I was reading an article...
Hang on, I'm just going to get a drink.
I was reading an article... I was reading an article and a headline caught my eye. And the headline that caught my eye was in the Chicago Tribune from April 25th of 1886. And the headline was "The History of Wife Beating."
Oh, nice.
And I was like...
Was that a lengthy article?
1886, or? It could have gone either way. They could have been really pro. but luckily they were against it. They were against the practice in general. But then next to that headline... was the headline, "Euphrasie Mercier, the story of France's latest sensational murder." And I was like, yep. Tell me more. So I read the article and I was like, I was pretty sold, but it wasn't just about that. It was this really strange article that morphed into like society news, you know, an actress being ill or something. So I was like, there's got to be more. And then I mean, check this out for an opening paragraph of an article from the Scotsman on the 13th of April, 1886. "It is rarely that the characters of a victim of religious hallucinations and a cold-blooded murderess who kills her benefactress from the most sordid motives combined in the same person. Yet, if we are to credit the evidence of medical experts, this phenomenon is presented in the case of Euphrasie Mercier."
Ooh,
yep.
Okay.
Yep.
I'm having fun.
Good.
I don't know what you're going on about.
You didn't read the articles. Honestly, it's just... I mean, I will say at the top, I'm not making fun of anybody in this article, in this show.
Oh, no.
Because there's a lot of... Nobody isn't a victim. They're all varying degrees of victims,
right.
Including Euphrasie Mercier herself. So just from that introductory paragraph, we have an accused murder, religious insanity, and what at the time would have been petty treason. I guess maybe it wasn't even petty treason still, but it was... That was murder. And it was reported all over the world. Like, I found it in the New York Times archive, I found it in Trove, I found it in the British Newspaper Archive, Chicago Tribune Archive. I didn't check newspapers.com, but I'm sure it was there.
You know, what else you missed is Papers Past, the New Zealand Archive.
That is true, I didn't check Papers Past.
I'm sure you would have found it, though.
Undoubtedly. This was like...
Yeah.
I think there's such a romance about Victorian France. Victorian Paris, you know, or whatever. I mean, this didn't actually take place in Paris, and so I'm talking shit there. But I just think it's it's like it's just this glamorous and mysterious place. But even though it was reported all over the world, there isn't a Wikipedia page.
Nice.
There is like a Murderpedia page, and there was...
Doesn't count.
Those guys do interesting work. But there's there was a TV drama based loosely on this story, as far as I can tell. And
interesting.
So I did some
in France or
in the UK. I did some of my research using Google, which I normally don't do. Normally I'll do it straight through the archive. But if you search for these things in Google, you will get results from like the New York Times archive, the Chicago Tribune archive.
Yeah.
So I use it occasionally. And using it this time, a book popped up, which is slightly outside the realms of what we do. But it was reporting. It was a book called Studies of French Criminals in the 19th Century. The whole book is free online. It's in Google Books by Henry Brodribb Irving, who wrote a lot of books about criminals around the turn of the century. It was written in 1901. I've added stuff in because it's just so sensationalized. but not that sensationalized. Like, you'll see. He goes into detail that I'm fairly sure he can't possibly know. I'm fairly sure there's speculation on his part, and he's just jazzed it up a bit. So, it's the story of... It's kind of the story of a lot of people, but it's the antagonist, I guess, is a woman called Euphrasie Mercier, who stood accused of murdering her employee, who was called Elodie Menetre.
Okay.
So all of this is in
very
French.
Very nice.
And I'm English. So I'm going to do what English people do. I'm going to try it the first couple of times. And I'm going to stop it.
And then you're going to call her...
Menetre.
You put her right side.
Just Menetre. Like, and all the French people listening will be grateful for me doing that because it will be less offensive
less
than what I'm doing to their language. Yeah. So it's Euphrasie Mercier and Elodie Menetre. I think a lot of the reporting with these things, if it happens in a foreign language, as soon as it is translated into English in some way, that is kind of how every single article will read. I don't think a lot of the newspapers are like, let's get this translated.
Yeah. They're not going right to the direct source.
No, no. So a lot of the reporting is similar. So I'll flick between a few articles, but they all follow a similar sort of theme, except for the Irving book, which is very, very rich. So this is an article from the Brisbane... Well, this is kind of the story from the Brisbane Courier from the 4th of June, 1886, right? I did some research in France. So you're welcome, French people. at the time of her trial, she was 67. Her trial was 1886. So let's say she was born in 1819. So it's just after the end of the Napoleonic Wars. And it's in a time of like quite on and off big unrest in France. So she was born into a relatively well-to-do family. She was the daughter of a cotton spinner in the department of the North. On his death, he left a fortune of 400,000 francs to be divided amongst his five children.
That sounds like a lot.
It was a lot. It was a lot.
Okay.
Over those five children, Euphrasie was the eldest, and and this is a thing that will come up again and again, she was really protective of her siblings.
Okay.
So they weren't the luckiest family, the Mercier family. Euphrasie carried on in the father's business and running it perfectly well, as far as I can tell. And then the revolutions of 1848 happened, which were a failed series of like Republican uprisings around Europe, like Sicily and Austria, I think. And the Brisbane Courier wrote that the revolution of 1848, however, broke out. There was stagnation of trade and the business was ruined. After bankruptcy, Euphrasie came to Paris, where for 15 years she led a miserable existence. She was in succession, cashier in a restaurant, dressmaker and shopwoman to a silk mercer. A lot of the reporting on her career is confusing.
In what way?
Well, they'll be like, yeah, and then she spent 12 years as a shopwoman to a silk mercer. But then some other articles will be like, she spent 12 years owning two shoe shops, and those years will cross over.
Okay.
I don't think a lot of diligence was put into this reporting because it's just so sensational. Why would we check?
She did a thing and then she murdered someone.
Basically, yeah. What does it matter what she did before?
Yeah.
So she's not doing great, Euphrasie.
But she's not living in the slums.
She's working.
Yeah. She could be doing a lot worse.
Yeah, she could. I mean, they call it a miserable existence. I'm not sure if that's relative to how she lived before, or she would have had to support her siblings, though, financially.
Right, so there were four, weren't there?
Yeah.
Four
so others. She's moving around a lot in this period. She's taking her siblings with her. Her siblings, as I mentioned, she was hugely protective of them. They had some kind of learning disability, or they had severe mental health problems, either like one of the two. I mean, I'm reading newspapers from the 1880s, so the language wasn't not very kind. I'll read some of that out shortly. But there's another aspect to the family that when you combine it with a really protective matriarch, it made the whole family really, really difficult to be around. The New York Times said that Euphrasie Mercier, like all her family, seems to be a religious enthusiast of the most extreme type. And this pops up again and again. This is like kind of really central to a lot of this story. And also it kind of... when the story goes on, it's like she does incredibly unchristian things. So you just, this kind of religious mania, it just seems to be like a convenient scapegoat for her problems, you know,
kind of like a protective.
Yeah, she has serious problems, and she channels it into being, you know, this religious fervor, and then she does things that are just so far from Christianity that it's.
So, if her siblings had mental illness or learning disabilities, is it likely that she also had some form of mental illness?
People go into this. It depends, doesn't it? Whether they were, you know, whether it was.
I guess it's not a given, but
it's not a given.
The chances would be
higher. Yeah.
Especially if she's going into religious mania,
and it does
maybe.
Yeah, completely.
Suggest that.
And it's confusing either way, because a lot of the newspapers will go as far as to say that her siblings were insane, but she wasn't. But I think partly that's so that there wasn't any leniency in the court case.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, that will all come out. Irving, in his book, wrote, "The story of Euphrasie Mercier is heightened in its weird character by the grotesque chorus of her crazy relations, the mad sisters who envelop her nefarious proceedings in a morbid atmosphere of religious
that's
mania."
Not okay.
And then he says, no, it gets worse. "These luckless creatures dragged from place to place in the wake of their resolute sister, whom she tends and watches over with extravagant devotion, constitute the motive of her crime. Like some possessed tigress, Euphrasie Mercier guards her brood of idiots and conceives and executes an atrocious murder to serve their pressing needs, herself a dangerous spirit that haunts but never passes beyond the confines of insanity." He writes that of the five children, three were mad. But religious mania was the form of insanity that had possessed the Mercier family. The high-sounding names he gave to his children show something of the kind latent in the father. He called them Euphrasie, Zachary, Camille, Honorine, and Sidonie. Of these, the last three were unquestionably the victims of pronounced religious mania, believing themselves guilty of imaginary sins, writing extravagant letters to the Pope and their bishop, in which they claimed to be in direct personal communication with God. The son Camille was firmly convinced that in the course of one night, a steam engine had absorbed his brain.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, that could be night terrors or something, but yikes.
Yeah.
So, Euphrasie's going from place to place, and she's towing her four siblings, three of whom are insane, behind her. And she's not in the best of mental health, you know. So it's just this family going around, and three of them are just screaming about God, and Euphrasie's really, really not a pleasant person. And
so, where's the mum?
Dead.
In all of this?
Dead.
And then, so what's happened to the money that the dad's left?
The revolution of 1848.
Right, okay. Getcha.
It just destroyed trade. It's like when in the American Civil War, but it caused a huge depression in the northwest of England because they weren't exporting cotton anymore. So it's just all these like little knock-on effects. So the Brisbane Courier, I think. I've just written the Courier because I was very confident in my script writing on this one. But this is continued from her career stuff earlier, her work earlier. I guess it is a career. In 1863, she had made a little money, and with it, she opened two shops for making and selling shoes. In 1875, she removed her business to the Boulevard Houseman, where she invited two sisters and a brother to stay with her. But in her new house, she did not succeed. She fell into arrears with her landlord and was driven out. She then went to Bois-Colombes, where she made a small income by lace-making, which, with the assistance she had from charitable funds, just enabled her to escape dying of hunger. Her misery came under the notice of a benevolent lady, Madame de Raskuska, who was like a Polish... I don't know if she was an aristocrat, but she was a wealthy Polish lady, who received her, and afterwards her two sisters and brother into her house as servants. So now this Madame de Raskuska has hired Euphrasie and her three insane siblings, one of whom thinks his brain has been eaten by a steam engine. The other two, like, imagine, they'd scream about God all the time. Like, no judgment or whatever, but imagine being Madame de Raskuska and being like, what have I hired?
Well, I guess she wouldn't see them very often, would she?
Oh, well. If
her house is big enough.
She
I don't know. I didn't see my servants very much.
She did see them. Because their conduct was that of religious lunatics, and they had to be discharged at the end of the year. The Scotsman reported it as the same incident. So after Raskuska hired them, they said, there, however, had developed a kind of religious mania described by the medical witnesses at the trial as mystic delirium, which, that sounds like a prog rock album.
I was just about to say that. And became, bit of a running theme we have going now.
Yeah, everything's an album. and became so troublesome that their protectress was at last obliged to dismiss them. Euphrasy's two sisters and her brother appear to have completely lost their mental balance, and they are all now in a lunatic asylum. So she managed to keep the shoe shops open for 12 years.
You know what? She has opened two shoe shops. She's made lace. What are the other things that she's done? Like, regardless of how her mental health was or anything else that she did, she was very skilled.
She has achieved more in these years than I probably ever will. That's depressing, given what comes next. But yeah, you've got to bear in mind that all the time in the shoe shop, she's like, ah, here's some shoes, God's shoes. Get some God's shoes. They've got souls.
Maybe she just saw, what's his face? The Sausage King in the gate market. And she was like, oh, this is how you draw a crowd. And she just didn't quite do it right.
He had a French shop.
Yeah, this
maybe,
is true.
Maybe she ate the Sausage King sausages. I also wrote a lot of jokes about souls. I've been them all. I got rid of
them. Oh my god, I nearly had a poem this week, which was about how a man is like his shoes, and that had a lot of soul and soul jokes. But the last two lines of that were, "And when a shoe is dead, it's mended new, and when people die, they're mended too."
I'm almost sure I did that poem in another episode. I've read that poem.
I don't remember doing it in an episode, but...
Maybe I just read it. But I do like how the last 3 minutes of us talking have me been saying, I nearly told some jokes, and yours were, I nearly read a poem. That's the kind of anecdotes you can expect from the professionals at yesterday's shit paper.
And we make that editorial decision to leave that out and then just bring it back in anyway.
Yeah, and I don't want you to edit this out. I want this in there. I want people to see the real...
Man, I'm not editing anything.
Great.
And they better enjoy it.
Yeah, edit that out. the business fails.
12 years, though. That's a good crack.
Yeah. This is where it gets a little bit confusing with the chronology. So every business has failed. They've been taken into the warm embrace of a benefactress, but their siblings were just way too much to handle. They were kicked out. And now, this is one of those moments of like, from here on, everything is going to be bad. Kind of like a sliding doors thing, where if this incident... kind of like the movie Sliding Doors, which was
like
bad.
Like Gwyneth Paltrow.
Yes.
Had a bad day at the shoe shop.
Gwyneth Paltrow could not handle living in 1880s Paris.
She couldn't keep her job for the first 5 minutes of that movie. What's she going to do here?
She would have cholera within seconds.
She'd be trying to drink the green water and they'd be like, don't drink that.
honestly, in 140 years, I'll be selling this shit for loads. Don't worry about it. So this is like one of those moments where if it hadn't happened, if this dog hadn't gone missing, and I'm not even joking, if a dog hadn't gone missing, Ella de Menetre would have lived her whole life and never died. But it didn't happen.
Jesus Christ, she'd be standing here now instead of me.
Yeah.
She'd be hosting this podcast with you.
Well, she wouldn't need to do any research.
And she'd be doing a better French pronunciation than you would.
Well, she would.
Just saying.
I mean, she would be French, so I'd probably be doing better English than she would. Just. Ella de Menetre is a... I'm going to stop doing it because I know it's wrong, but I also don't... I don't want them to think I'm not trying.
Don't give up.
She was an educated and well-heeled woman, but she did have the faint whiff of scandal about her. So the Irving book talks about her unhappy birthright and says that her father had been killed in Africa in the course of some exploit of illicit love. His dishonorable death had slowly killed his wife and left their children orphans. The newspapers were kind of dickheads about her, to be honest. Like, her private life became public business. The New York Times said that she came from an excellent family and was finely educated, but she had been thrown when very young into the temptations of Parisian life, with no protector to care for her, and had fallen like many a beautiful and refined woman before her. She had saved some of the money coming for her inheritance, and she had two friends, each of whom made her an allowance. So the two articles there are skirting around what they mean, which is that Euphrasy had quite a few lovers at this at this age. She's like 45 years old. She's had quite a few lovers, and two of them kind of sponsor her, kind of pay for her, you know.
Okay.
And this, whoever wrote this at the Scotsman, I don't like them. So it says, Mademoiselle Menatre was a woman of respectable family and of considerable property, but of dubious moral character. Her income was partly derived, indeed, from allowances made to her by two men with whom she had formerly had improper relations. Shut up. So anyway, so Elodie Menatre is this 45-year-old woman. She's doing fine. She's been popular with the chaps. Two of them pay for her to live.
I mean, it sounds ideal.
I wish that... I had two friends who just paid for me.
Oh, God. Imagine having two friends who liked you enough to just pay for you to be there.
Imagine having two friends. Wow.
Oh, man.
Little pie in the sky stuff. So she was doing fine. In 1882, she lost her dog.
Oh, no.
Yes.
What was the dog called?
I have a feeling it was Rico.
Rico? That's such a great name.
It is a great name. But I might have made it up.
I think it was Rico.
Yeah. Yeah. Would be, wouldn't it? Irving said that what happened was, and I meant to screenshot this bit of the story, but I haven't, so I'm going off memory. And I have an impeccable memory, ladies and gentlemen.
He's lying.
I have a terrible memory.
Don't listen to
him. He said, Menatre was in there looking for some shoes, talking to Mercier, and she thought she saw somebody go past with her dog. So she said to Mercier, do you mind if I come and stand here for the next a couple of hours every day for the next week and just see if this person goes past with my dog again? And Mercier was like, and she was like, good, I'll take that as a yes. the Beverly and East Riding Recorder on the 29th of August, 1885, backs up the dog story, kind of. It says that the beginning of the acquaintance was Mercier having found a pet dog which Mademoiselle Menatre had lost. So let's say there was a dog.
Okay.
Yeah.
Go, Rico.
Rico. So one good turn deserves another. When Euphrasy fell on hard times, Menatre heard about it and offered... I'm just going to call her Elodie because it's nicer.
Yeah.
Elodie heard about it and offered to take her in. Elodie had just purchased, according to the New York Times, a small estate near a place called Villemomble, where she intended to retire. So she was like, hey, do you want to come and be my, I don't want to say servant, because
I don't like the term servant.
Yeah, you know,
I like the term house friend.
Yes.
Who
come and be my house elf?
It's like really cleanly.
Yeah, I want to
overly cleanly.
I want a friend
like everyone.
My other friends who just does everything for me. How about that? How do you feel about that? I'll give you some money to do it. So, as soon as Mercier moves in, trouble starts. Elodie was very, very prone to nerves. She was very anxious. And Mercier knew that. And someone like Mercier, who has been, you know, savagely protective of her siblings and just doing everything to, like, make money and keep her family alive for, you know, her entire life, she had become quite manipulative, I guess. I don't know if that made her manipulative or if she did that because she was manipulative, but she really preyed on Elodie's nerves. The Scotsman reported that Mercier soon acquired a strong influence over her and used it remorselessly for the purpose of terrorizing her. She pretended to have visions and to hear mysterious voices, and in a short time she had reduced Mademoiselle Menatre to a condition of extreme nervous discomfort. So Menatre...
So Euphrasy was just like, yeah! He was like, shit!
Yeah, it was... I think it was even...
What a household!
It was darker than that. Like, she would tell her stories. Have I put this anywhere? Yeah. That Irving wrote about in more detail what she did to Menatre. I mean, it's real, like, psychological... It's bullying in the absolute extreme because she's trying to break this woman down so she had complete power over her. So Menatre is basically in a prison of her own home. She was so scared of Mercier. It's just so sad. And this is why, like at the start, I said there's quite a few victims of this. Because I think Euphrasy is a victim to an extent of circumstance. I think her siblings are victims of Euphrasy. I don't think she's particularly pleasant with them. Menatre is obviously, you know, a victim. Raskuska maybe could be counted as one. There's no winners in this story. So Irving wrote that Elodie had been for some time a sufferer from nerves. In the boot shop, Euphrasie Mercier had been sympathetic enough with her condition, but in the new home, the old lady, with her pale, wrinkled face and hooked nose, seemed to take a strange delight in exciting rather than allaying her mistress's affliction. She began to trouble and distress her with horrid relations of ghosts. She told how solitary women had been strangled in their beds by cruel murderers to rob them of their gold. So Elodie, the New York Times said that Elodie was afraid of her servant and suspected her, but so complete was the control the woman had gained over her that she was afraid to discharge her. She told her fears to Monsieur Gracier, one of her old friends, and asked him to keep for her a duplicate of the list of her list of securities and to lock up her jewels in his house. So Elodie is scared to the point of... Yeah, exactly. She's scared to the point of telling people. She's removing her jewels from her house because she thinks something's coming. She can't fire Euphrasie because she's so scared of her. So this is... I'm quite an anxious person. I don't deal well with, you know, conflicts and things. To have that in my home and to be trapped by it and not be able to get out of the situation, that's just, it's horrible. I can't even, it's so claustrophobic and so just, I can't even imagine how horrible it must be.
Yeah, it's one of those things that makes an incredible story and then you do forget they did actually happen to real people.
Well, that's the thing with these newspapers is that, like, when if I read, you know, a non-fiction book and it's like about, you know, Victorian London and all this horrible stuff's happening, like a Jack the Ripper book or whatever, you're like, wow, what a story. And then maybe not everyone, but then you kind of read it in a newspaper and it's like, wow, man, this is like, these are just normal people.
I guess because it's so, when you read a history book or something, it's so far removed from the people and the events when they happened. Whereas when you've got actual quotes and things from people.
Yeah.
That's when shit gets real.
And shit is about to get quite real. My accent does not lend itself to dramatic statements. If that was in a film, Owen.
Oh, what do you mean?
Believe me, shit is about to get quite real. you just watch, Sonny. So the Times continued that Euphrasie discovered she was suspected, which, oh no, and she filled her mistress's mind with all kinds of fantastic ideas, until Mademoiselle Menetre, naturally nervous and excitable, became practically a haunted woman to whom life was an unending torture. She was troubled with violent pains in the stomach, and those she tried to allay by narcotics, which Euphrasie prepared for her. These were increased in quantity until the woman sank into a state of complete prostration. On April 21st, 1882, Monsieur Gracier saw her for the last time. When he called again a few days later, he was told by Euphrasie that her mistress had gone to America. And Euphrasie is going to come out with quite a lot of bullshit about that. But basically what's happened, as I think you can probably tell, Euphrasie is up to the quantity of whatever she's giving Elodie, and she's killed her. Oh, also, in some accounts of this, the neighbour was Madame Gracier. Some of it is Monsieur Gracier, some of it is Madame Gracier. So I don't know if that's... They were like, whatever, there's confusion there. So if you're in Mercier's position and you've clearly killed a rich person, do you take the money and run away? Or do you
do... That sounds good to me.
...what Euphrasie did, which, according to the New York Times...
Blame God!
He makes another cameo. On April 27th, she wrote to her brother and two sisters, telling them that Mademoiselle Menetre had gone abroad, leaving her in possession of the property and asking them to come and live with her, an invitation which they promptly accepted. Then she had prepared a document, alleged to have been signed by Elodie, stating that in consideration of 1,800 francs, a receipt for 4,200, a year for her mistress had rented her the house, and a receipt for 4,200 francs in payment of the rent for 1 year and for the furniture in the house. So she's killed her, and then got her...
Invited the family around.
Her religiously insane siblings to come and live with her, forged a document to pay rent on the place, and just carried on living there. And a lot of the articles...
I mean, it's bold.
It is bold. It is bold. I can't... I mean... Yeah.
That's nuts.
Yeah. And it gets nutser.
So, dead Elodie is still there. She hasn't left the equation somehow.
She didn't leave. Good God. But Elodie...
She didn't leave on her own account.
Euphrasie's bullshit gets ramped up to, like... This one goes to 11. So she shut the house off to everyone. And when they asked where Elodie was, Mercier would then just change it. So it was America initially. And now she says she ran off to be a nun. But she said she would not betray her friend by telling anyone where she was nunning.
And then she was like, actually, no, sorry, I got confused. She's appearing in Sister Act on Broadway.
Yes, she's back in the habit.
That's what it was. Sorry, guys, got a bit confused there.
I will say, if someone has run off to be a nun, they've definitely been murdered.
Arguable. I mean, you could.
So. I don't think so.
You can make that case.
I think I'm definitely checking. I'm like, really? Just ran off to be a... Really? Didn't mention it.
Do you know if Elodie was at all religious?
Nope, she wasn't religious.
Probably her friends would have known that, right?
She didn't really have any friends. She was new, she didn't have to live in the area.
Well, what about, I mean, like her friends, like her two wealthy friends who paid for her. I guess maybe they wouldn't even know.
Elodie
anything.
Just shut the house off to everybody. Shut the house off to everybody. Yeah. Nobody could get in. And it was a lot of lazy local policing as well, which I'll come to. Hmm. She knocks it up another notch. She found a notch to knock up to. To which to knock up. So one of her friends, this is from The Scotsman. One of her friends, a theatre manager in Paris, hearing a rumour that she was illegally confined, Elodie, made representations to the police authorities and caused an inquiry to be initiated by them. But he complained at the trial that it had been a mere sham. Even if it had been something more, there would have been little cause for surprise if Mercier had contrived to baffle it. She had prepared quite a series of documents supporting her story that Mademoiselle Menetre had gone abroad and had transferred her house to her. Right, get this shit. She sold all the silver plate and other valuables that belonged to her mistress and even contrived, by forging the name, to draw the dividends on her securities. In 1883, apparently thinking that the expedient of forgery was rather risky, this enterprising person went to Luxembourg, taking all Mademoiselle Menetre's papers with her. She introduced herself to a notary of that city, one Monsieur Rassounet, as Mademoiselle Menetre, and caused him to draw up a power of attorney and in favour of Sophie Mercier, Sophie being her own second name. So she's just signed all this over to herself. Armed with this document, which was quite regular in form, she speedily...
Wow, anything's possible in Luxembourg.
As I've said a million times, everyone was just making it up. Armed with this document, which was quite regular in form, she speedily effected the transfer of all the invested funds which stood in Mademoiselle Menetre's name to her own account, sold them, and invested the proceeds in a landed property in the north of France.
Very nice.
That's bold. Just for a second, she's gone to Luxembourg, pretended to be Elodie, to sign everything over to herself, and then appeared in court and been like, well, I have all the paperwork. So you look pretty stupid right now. You look pretty stupid right now.
No, Jesus Christ, get her out. Get her out. The house is yours. It's fine.
So some of it, you're like, wow, she's got her head screwed on. She knows how to commit crime. And then there's bits where you're like, no, she doesn't know what she's doing. So when Mercier was reported to the police, according to Irving, she had letters that were supposed to be from Elodie saying, I'll be back on Wednesday, but not saying which Wednesday.
Oh, everything was so good up to that point.
Yeah. This is when you're just like, hot. So Irving reported, Mercier at the same time produced a document which she was pleased to style as a deed of gift. It said, and this isn't funny. This is really probably the worst bit of all of this, except for the fact that Elodie's dead. So Mercier at the same time produced a document which she was pleased to style a deed of gift. It said, and this is in quotes, I quit France. I leave all to Mademoiselle Mercier. Let her transact my affairs. True, Irving says, this document was somewhat formless, written in a hand that betrayed agony of body or agitation of mind. In fact, a document full of unpleasant suggestion, but it was unquestionably in the handwriting of Mademoiselle Menetre, and that was sufficient for all practical purposes. Closer investigations seemed unnecessary. So she's either mentally or physically tortured Elodie and made her sign away all of her belongings.
That is dreadful.
That was the bit when I was like...
That is horrific.
Yeah, because at that point, Elodie's got to know that she's going to die as soon as she signed that, you know. Or maybe she signed it to stop herself being killed, but she's being slowly poisoned, you know. God, it's rough. Okay. So, bold. we're talking about Jesus Christ. This actually made...
I think we've moved beyond bold now.
When I read this, I gasped. And I don't think it's true. I think it's just Irving throwing a little bit of sass on it. But after the trip to Luxembourg, it meant that everything that Menatre had owned was now either owned by or had been sold by Mercier. And Irving said, and I hope it's not true, but I kind of hope it is, Mercier returned to Villemomble and did not hesitate to remind the two gentlemen who made small allowances to Mademoiselle Menatre that their quarterly payments were overdue.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah. Savage.
Did they pay it?
They had to.
Why?
Because she owned the estate. It was payments to the estate.
Yeah.
So,
oh, I see.
Whoever saw this coming? Which of them would have been like, what if someone kills you and assumes your identity in Luxembourg and steals all your stuff? What then, Elodie?
Christ.
A good point.
Go, Euphrasy was smart.
Yeah, yes and no.
Like, it's weird how smart someone so insane can be.
I just don't know. It's really, she's such a complicated character. And I think she did a lot of this for her siblings. Because she just wanted them to have a good life.
This is the other thing. I was going to say maybe she just like had no kind of like empathy. But she is basically doing it for her family.
Yeah, and to make herself comfortable. So, I mean, she's...
It's such a tricky one.
She's very, very complicated. I mean, fundamentally incredibly unpleasant. But that isn't the most... I mean, stealing the money from those guys, stealing everything from the woman you killed and everything, whatever, those are stories that are, you know, really old. But they lived at the house for 2 years. Elodie's house. They
did without anyone questioning it.
Yeah, they didn't take the money and go away. They just lived there for 2 years.
And Elodie?
She was at a convent, as far as anyone was concerned.
Yeah, but where was she really?
She was dead.
For 2 years.
She was dead.
Yeah, but what happened to the body? This is what I'm trying to find out.
Oh, we'll get there.
It's what happened to the corpse.
We'll get there. The thing that I found the most sad is in those 2 years, no one cared about Elodie. She had a sister who was a ballet dancer in the Paris Opera who didn't check on her throughout this entire time. I had no idea anything any of this had happened. Didn't care.
2 years.
Yeah. In 1885, the New York Times reported that she settled down to the peaceful enjoyment of her mistress's property, in which pleasing occupation she would be probably engaged now, but for a graceless nephew whom she took into her head in her old age to fall in love with. That nephew was Alphonse Chateauneuf, an illegitimate son of one of her sisters. He was a deserter from the French army who had been to America but had returned to Europe and sent his aunt a letter from Brussels. This was in July of last year, and Euphrasie, on receiving the letter, at once went to Brussels and induced Alphonse to return and live with her at Villemomble. He came, and from that time, the fate of Euphrasie was pronounced. Which I'd love to be able to write something like that. Also, because he was a deserter from the French army, he had to go to the town dressed as a woman, because they'd have killed him if they found him.
Wow.
I found reports that I can't find again, which is annoying, because it would have added even more to this story. I found a report that Euphrasie and Alphonse were sleeping together.
Okay.
She is his aunt, not by marriage.
I see.
They're direct blood relatives. And I found one article that was very, very explicit about it. That article I just read said they fell in love. She fell in love with him. The next article, from the Bury and Norwich Post from the 13th of October 1885, it's reporting from the trial, says, when his aunt first saw him in the garden, she cried out to him not to say anything about certain relations which had existed between them at one time. So I think they were doing it.
I think you need to find your sources for that.
They were doing it.
Before you start throwing things like that around.
That's a source.
Yeah. Ish.
Not to say anything about certain relations which existed between them. And he was also sleeping with his cousin. So it's not above him. Below him. Above him. Above him. Below him. Shut up. I don't know. but like, if they, honestly, if he had a kid with any of these people, it would just be like a smooth egg with one arm. Like, this would be a deformed child.
No, stop.
So, for Alphonse, this is great. Euphrasie's somehow wealthy. That's great. He's sleeping with most of his extended family. Great. That's that box ticked. Then, he gets suspicious or greedy. I think greedy, because I think when he arrived, he was like, right, this is clearly illegal in some way. There's no way that she's just somehow a millionaire. And then I think he decided to blackmail her. And the way that he represented himself was that he became suspicious. So he says, according to his own account, he at first believed that she had come legitimately into the possession of Mademoiselle Menetre's wealth, but some documents that he found in the drawer led him to surmise that the unfortunate woman had been made away with and her body buried in the garden.
Well, that answers my question.
That's pretty much. And part of this was because there was one flower bed that the gardener was banned to go near. I'm not even joking. If you're burying people in your garden, do your own garden.
We're being theoretical here, right?
No, I mean, this is just good sense. Do your own gardening. Or just don't. Just get it paved over.
But she was, right? She wasn't hiring anyone
at
this point.
There was a gardener.
She wasn't that wealthy.
There was a gardener.
What?
Yeah.
She had home help.
No.
She had a house friend.
I don't think he lived there. I think maybe he just came around like once a week to do the beds or whatever. So
make sure the bodies weren't showing.
Well, in the end, if that was his job, he didn't do well. But she was like, yeah, anything but don't touch that flower bed. And he must have been like, why? And she was like,
God told me.
She just made that noise until he went away. He was like, oh, okay, I just won't touch it, that's fine. So he was really sneaky about this, Alphonse. And I don't know if that makes his moral character any better or worse, but he was very sneaky. Euphrasy mentioned to him the idea of selling the property. And Alphonse was like, because he knew at this point that Elodie's buried in the hyacinth bed or something. Euphrasy like just was batting around with him the idea of selling the property and moving to the place up north.
Oh yeah, Jesus Christ, she's got the other property.
Yeah, so she can just go now.
Why is she even living there?
Well, quite. I don't know. I don't know if it's one of those like the arrogance of a criminal or if it's just nicer. But she was talking about selling it. And Alphonse was like, yeah, sounds good. You'd have to warn the new owners not to plant any trees, though, you know, in case this was, a cemetery and there were bones. And then he demanded 25,000 francs to keep his mouth shut. And she said, no. So the aunt declined to accede to this demand for hush money, and Alphonse promptly returned to Brussels, from which he couldn't call them from France because he would have been arrested as a deserter. So he went to Brussels, he called the police, and it says that was the end of Euphrasie Mercier's career as a landed proprietor, which I think is a really weird way of phrasing that, because it wasn't really a career.
Yeah,
she killed someone and forged
really
documents.
The point of it.
Yeah, it's the end of her career as a forger.
A forger and person getting away with murder.
Yeah, and the beginning of her career as a prisoner, I suppose. And of course, also, for Alphonse to be like, anyway, I grew suspicious. Bullshit. Because Euphrasie, according to Irving, was walking around the house, right? She would then kiss the ground 16 times, crawling backwards all the while, after which, rising to her feet, she would throw open the window and cry out, in the name of God, get hence, Beelzebub, Lucifer, and thou, Satan, hence with your legions of devils, back, judges, commissaires, assize court, back, ye terrors that beset me, back, phantoms of my garden, family of Menetre, rest in the peace of God and the glory of the elect. Amen.
Wow, so that's like a really long way of saying...
I killed someone who's buried in my garden.
A man. Oh, a woman. Yeah. A woman.
A woman. That's what they call them in France. So I'm sorry, if you're hearing that and you're like, and then I grew suspicious. No, she just told you she did it. So she was arrested. The Scotsman said, Mercier was arrested and on excavations being made in the lawn at the house. The remains of a female were found there. They had evidently been subjected to the action of fire, but among them were found a false tooth and another that had been stopped with gold. It was ascertained that one of Elodie's teeth was false, and in 1871 her dentist had stopped another with gold. Further traces were found in one of the fireplaces of the house of the burning of animal matter, and chimney sweeps recovered deposits of fatty matter in the soot of the chimney. I don't think that was Rico. I hope it wasn't
Rico. It was the one thing she was missing. The one thing of Elodie's that she didn't have was Rico.
You think Rico's just in a bar smoking a cigarette? It's like, I can't get back there.
No, he came back like glassy, like bounded back into the house, and then Euphrasie was just like, bah!
He just jumped straight in the fire.
That's sad.
That is sad. That is sad. That's the saddest bit.
God.
So from start to finish, she was had a business, lost the business, had a business, lost the business, lost the business, had a business, went in with Madame the Raskuska, was kicked out because her siblings were insane. They went in an asylum. She went through some crazy dog scheme to get into Menetre's house, killed Menetre, took all Menetre's stuff, moved her brothers and sister in, or sisters and brother, lived there for 2 years, and then a nephew came over. She's doing it with the nephew, right?
Can't do it with someone.
I guess if you're living on a veil of secrecy, you can't be like, doing Tinder. But, like, just the all caps in her bio. And now she's been caught. And really, it took a while to catch her because she wasn't hiding in plain sight with this bullshit. So the quote that I opened the story with from The Scotsman, it is rarely that the characters of a victim of religious hallucinations and a cold-blooded murderess who kills her benefactress from the most sordid motives are combined in the same person. Yet if we are to credit the evidence of medical experts, this phenomenon is presented in the case of Euphrasie Mercier, which now sounds like, yep.
Wow.
There's details from her trial which are crazy. She had long arguments with Alphonse and his cousin, who he married. I'm not going to read out the conversation of the court because there were so many of them. But she varied between saying God told her to do it and then flat out denying that she did it. She denied murdering Elodie and she kept saying that she'd gone to a convent. And this is where her lies are just like, what are you doing? She said she'd gone to a convent. She said that I was the owner of the home and Elodie was my servant. But I don't like people knowing about my financial situation.
That's a good one.
Yeah, I mean, she tried everything. She said that Elodie was in love with someone she couldn't marry, so she ran to a convent. And then when they said, okay, fine, which convent? Because Euphrasie had said that Elodie lived in like 6 different countries. She was like, yeah, she's one in Germany, one in Austria, Italy, I think. But Euphrasie was like, yeah, she moves around. She writes me letters. And they were like, can you produce her letters? And she said, no, I always send them back. She asks me to. She's very secretive. And my favorite bit was they said, my favorite lie that she told, just because of the response of the prosecution, she was asked if she'd seen Elodie in the past 2 years. And Euphrasie was like, yes, I met her secretly under the clock at the Gare du Nord. And the prosecution was like, do you think convents just let people out to roam around? Like, what kind of convent is she in that she could just go and walk around outside? That's not how it works in convents. So I will let the New York Times take this one home. She denied that she was responsible for the disappearance of her mistress, who she asserted was still living, but whose address she could not give. During the third day of the trial, the president of the assizes received this telegram. This is, again, just really, it's like chaos magic. She's just making her own reality. The president of the assizes received this telegram. Bordeaux. I have come back from America. Suspend sentence, Elodie Menetre. But no notice was taken of this dispatch, which was evidently a forgery, as Elodie had not appeared to verify it. Euphrasie on the trial conducted herself in a most extraordinary manner, at times assuming the dignity of an old lady of fashion, and at others sneering and giggling. She constantly interrupted each of the 80 witnesses in the case, calling on God to witness their treachery to truth, and insisted that Elodie, when she disappeared, was sent away by supernatural agencies which she could not resist. The doctors who testified were convinced that all the Mercier family were more or less tainted with madness, but that the prisoner, owing to her energy of character, had resisted the tendency and was simply acting for the purposes of making the court believe her insane. The trial has attracted a great deal of attention, and the case will take rank as one of the most remarkable ever known in France. Which is interesting because I asked a French person who's into sort of true crime whether she'd heard of this and she hadn't. She got extenuating circumstances. She was given the maximum sentence she could be given was 20 years because of the extenuating circumstances, which effectively meant because of her age, it was a life sentence. And because of her age, she didn't do hard labor. They didn't give it to anybody over 60, I think, or 65. And to put a nice little full stop on it, during the trial, Alphonse wrote like a penny dreadful about the murder called The Mystery of Villemomble. I would love to read
Jesus Christ.
Yeah, I'd really like to read that.
I would bank on like 20% of that being fact.
Oh, yeah. if that.
That's a crazy story.
It's sordid. There's nobody comes out of it looking well. looking good.
God, that could not happen in the age of social media.
Well, no, you would hope not.
2 years.
Two audacious years. Yeah.
I mean, someone would have realized that Elodie wasn't checking into her usual spots, you know?
And I'm kind of annoyed. I'm annoyed at the police force for just not doing anything. Like, what were they doing? Do something. But anyway, that's the story of... I'm going to say a story of Elodie Menatre, because your phrasey mercy, you can go and fuck yourself. So what we also like to do is sort of palate cleanser after this misery is old newspapers have these really fun letters and poems that people used to write in, and they're a really good indicator of what was important to people then, and kind of what the level of acceptable writing was in many ways. So each week we go and find a letter and a poem, kind of partly to take the onus off so that we can alternate the masses of research and writing the big stories take. So Violet, what have you found?
I have found, both of mine come from Trove this week. So they're both Australian papers, and my letter is a letter written to a paper, but it's not your typical letter to the editor. So this story came from the Sydney Evening News on the 10th of October, 1903. And it had the headline, "A Baby at a Newspaper Office."
Okay, good.
And then two subheadlines: "Found on the Doorstep, Likes the Place."
Fine. Yeah, why not?
And the print is really bad, so bear with me. But the story continues. "At 7:30 a.m. on Wednesday, 7th instant, a male baby about a month old was found lying on the doorstep of a side entrance to the Australian Woman offices at 84 Hunter Street. He was fairly well dressed and, when discovered, was vigorously sucking a soother. Only stopping now and again to smile contentedly all around in response to the many exclamations of surprise which his unexpected appearance had evoked. The baby's basket came with a letter that said, 'To the editress, I don't know what to do with my baby. I have done my best for him, but I can't keep him any longer. I have to go to work, and nobody will employ me if I have a child to care for. It breaks my heart to part from him, but I can't keep him to starve. As yours is a woman's paper, I thought someone in your office might keep him for me until I can look after him again myself. I might be able to take him when I have been in work a few months, and then I will tell you who I am. He was a month old on Sunday. When I saw the children's hospital picture in your paper, I thought you must be fond of children. If you are good to my baby, I am sure God will bless you, and someday I may be able to repay you.' The letter was neither signed nor dated. No one felt disposed to hand the child over to the police, so it was finally decided to give him a temporary home at the office, various persons on the premises agreeing to take charge of him in turn. His strange surroundings evidently agree with him, as he has slept almost incessantly since his discovery. The proprietor of the paper, however, would like it to be understood that he does not intend his office to be converted into a foundling home, and should any similar arrivals take place, he would feel compelled to hand the matter over to the police for attention."
That's simultaneously very, very sad and very, very sweet.
I think he's Richard Branson now.
Yeah, he's Batman.
But
I just like the idea of the editor being like, "Oh Christ, now they're all going to send him here." I wonder if the kid ever got collected.
I did look it up to see if I could find anything else on it, but I didn't find anything. But I'd like to think so.
Yeah, me too.
I mean, it's a very well-written letter. Maybe they could have just employed her as a writer.
Yeah.
There you go. That's an idea for you.
There's a solution. But she didn't leave a LinkedIn or anything, so.
Yeah, that's the problem. And then my poem for the week comes from the Central Queensland Herald on the 21st of December, 1933. They ran an unorthodox poetry competition in that they asked people to send in the worst verse they could possibly write.
Oh, amazing. Because I just thought people did that anyway in in that newspaper.
You know what? The wisecrack you just made, there were so many of that in this article, but I just snipped one line from it. They were like, oh, it was kind of hot because they ran a few different competitions simultaneously for like the best short story and the best poetry. And then they ran the worst one as well. And so they were like, well, we thought some of them got mixed up in which one they were entering.
But they said it is... demean people's work. That's what you should do.
And you know what they did? I found this twice. I've never seen this before in a paper, but I found two different poetry competitions in different papers where they said, here is our winner, and they put down the winner. And then they were like, here is our commentary on the other entries.
That's great.
And they had like five or six entries, and then they'd be like, so-and-so's poem. And then they wouldn't publish the poem. They just published like, yeah, we didn't think this was very good. That's... like, it didn't really have...
I'm a fan of that. I like that.
Yeah, it was weird. But I kind of also wanted to read the poems that went with the commentary.
Yeah.
But they said, it is less easy than might be imagined to write deliberately bad verse, and the competition attracted only four entries. And the winner was called False.
Mm.
False friends of mine, why do you thus evade me? What have I done that you should treat me so? Oft have you shown your brightness gleaming whitely, and smiled for me when trouble did appear. So, I mean, there's the first problem, is none of this actually rhymes. But that's fine. I mean, it's in stanzas. Now, I am sure I cannot do without you. What shall I do when dinner time draws nigh? False friends of mine, oh, tell me where I placed you, so that my smile is not an aching void. False friends of mine, how pleased I am to find you. Never again shall I mislay you thus. I can now chew and masticate my crusts. True friends of mine, though my false teeth you are.
Oh. I saw it coming. God.
That was by Anne Dante.
I feel like Anne wrote that and then sent it into the worst thing as a joke. And then when it won, she was secretly like, that's really upset me.
Maybe.
I'd anticipated that you would actually...
That's enthusiastic.
Publish it as something that shouldn't have been sent in. But whatever, you guys are... Whatever, you guys don't understand poetry. God, that poem. All right. Well, that makes our show, I think. We have had murder, we have had a missing mother.
Missing dog.
Pretty happy baby.
Missing teeth.
Missing teeth. Missing talent as well.
Still looking.
Yeah. So
he's not referring to us.
No, I'm talking about Andante. So thank you as always for tuning in.
I wonder if she had a sister called El Dente.
Oh my God, are you gonna enter into a composition?
I'm practicing.
Thank London, you, as always, for tuning in. We will put all of the sources in our show notes.
If you want to find out any more about the stories that we've covered this week or other stories, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Paper Podcast on both.
And then while you are on this internet, if you fancy going over to iTunes or Stitcher or wherever you get your podcast, we'd really appreciate it if you could rate and review us. It only takes a couple of minutes and it really, really helps us.
And you know what? While you're also online, just check in with those friends that you haven't seen for 2 years.
Yeah.
Just see if they're alive.
Give them a shout.
Playing us out are Al Jolson and Sophie Taylor with the International Rag, thanks to the Free Music Archive.
Thank you, Free Music Archive. We'll be back in a couple of weeks. Thank you.
Bye. International. The International Rag.